Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in Genesis chapter 49. I'm going to cover the last half of the chapter between verses 19 through 33. We will see Jacob continuing to bless his sons right before he dies. He'll die at the end of the chapter. Our context is this. In the first half of Genesis 49:1, Jacob was blessing his sons. I did that in the last audio. The chapter before that, in chapter 48, Jacob blessed Ephraim and Manasseh, who were Joseph's two sons. He's going to come back and bless Joseph a little bit here in this chapter 2. So basically, we're talking about the blessings of Jacob as he blesses the patriarchs before Jacob dies. We start now in Genesis 49:19. Well, before we start in 19, let's see how we stopped off in our last audio in Genesis 49:18. Jacob said, "For your salvation I wait, O Lord." He's waiting for the promises to be fulfilled. He's thinking about the afterlife, I'm sure. He stops right in the middle of blessing his sons, and he says, "For your salvation I wait, O Lord." It does seem kind of strange that he would do that. Some people speculate he was worn out and tired. He was a dying man, and so he had to wait before he went on with his blessings. But at any rate, we start with Genesis 49, verse 19. Jacob continues, "As for Gad, raiders shall raid him, but he will raid at their heels." Now, in Hebrew, Gad means a troop, as John Gill says. And Gill says, further, there is an allusion to Gad in almost every word of the verse. Well, I don't know Hebrew, so I'll take his word for it. Now, we see that Gad will do two things. He will be raided, and he will raid. Raiders shall raid him, that's be raided, and he will raid his enemies. So let's see how that was fulfilled. Raiders shall raid him. How was Gad raided? Gad was vulnerable to raids by tribes beyond the Jordan, as the NIV Study Bible and Gill say, since Gad was on the other side of the Jordan. The two and a half tribes over the Jordan were Manasseh, half tribe of Manasseh, and then Gad, and then Reuben. And the way I remember that is MGR going north to south, manager. Manasseh is to the east of Sea of Galilee and Lake Hula up there in the north. And then as you go to the east of the Jordan River down between the Sea of Galilee and the Dead Sea, roughly that is Gad. You go south of Gad, south of the Gad, and going on down to the east coast of the top part of the Dead Sea, northern part of the Dead Sea, is Reuben, MGR. Manasseh, half Manasseh, Gad, and Reuben. Now, since Gad was over there on the east side, Gad was vulnerable to raids by tribes who were over there beyond the Jordan. So let's look at some tribes that successfully raided Gad. Jeremiah 49:1. About the Ammonites, this is what the Lord says. Does Israel have no sons? Is he without an heir? Why then has Milcom dispossessed Gad and his people settled in their cities? Milcom is the god of the Ammonites. Now, the commentator Ellicott said that this failure, being raided, Gad being raided by the Ammonites, occurred apparently after the successful raids that Gad had made against the eastern tribes. Now, we can look at another verse that shows the failure of the Gadites as they were successfully raided by eastern tribes in Judges 10:8. They shattered and crushed the Israelites that year, and for 18 years they did the same to all the Israelites who were on the other side of the Jordan, in the land of the Amorites in Gilead. Of course, that includes the Israelites who were on the other side of the Jordan, includes Gad, as well as half Manasseh and Reuben. So Gad was successfully raided, and so Jacob's prophecy was correct in Genesis 49:19. As for Gad, raiders shall raid him. Now let's look and see where Gad raided the eastern tribes. The last part of verse 19 in Genesis 49 says, but he, Gad, will raid at their heels. So this is where he's raiding successfully, not being raided, but raiding successfully against the eastern tribes. Here's a quote from Ellicott. This warlike and independent tribe, referring to Gad, seem to have been successful in repelling the bands of marauders, Ammonites, Moabites, and Arameans who threatened the eastern border of Gilead. Now the Ammonites and the Moabites, of course, are those two kingdoms that are to the east of the Dead Sea, the Ammonites being to the north of the Moabites. And of course, that's right to the south of Gad. And so they would have a tendency to want to attack Gad. And Gad would, of course, be prone to attack them because they were on their borders. Arameans are even further to the north as you go up through half Manasseh and on into Syria. Now, Ellicott quotes some scriptures showing these raids. Let's look first at 1 Chronicles 5, 18 through 22. And we'll see how Gad, along with Reuben and half Manasseh, how they stomp on some of these eastern tribes. 1 Chronicles 5, 18 through 22, the descendants of Reuben and Gad and half the tribe of Manasseh had 44,760 warriors who could serve in the army, men who carried shield and sword, drew the bow, and were trained for war. They waged war against the Hagrites, Jeter, Naphish, and Nodab. They received help against these enemies because they cried out to God in battle. And the Hagrites and all their allies, these tribes are, I don't know who these tribes are, but they're eastern tribes over there. And the Hagrites and all their allies were handed over to them. He was receptive to their prayer, God was, because they, the eastern tribes, including Gad, trusted in him. They captured the Hagrites' livestock, 50,000 of their camels, 250,000 sheep, and 2,000 donkeys, as well as 100,000 people. Many of the Hagrites were killed because it was God's battle, and they lived there in the Hagrites' place until the exile. So you see this huge victory. This was not a small battle. I mean, we're talking about 250,000 sheep and 100,000 people, 50,000 camels. So Gad raided successfully. As Jameson Fawcett Brown says, Gad was generally victorious in the close of their war. So Jacob's prophecy is fulfilled very clearly here for Gad. Now we go to, it was fulfilled two ways. Raider shall raid Gad. I gave you examples in Jeremiah 49:1 and Judges 10:8, and Gad will raid at their heels. We saw that in 1 Chronicles 5, 18 through 22. So now we go to Genesis 49:20. Jacob continues, as for Asher, his food shall be rich, and he will yield royal dainties. The Hebrew for Asher means happy or blessed. His food shall be rich. That's because Asher inherited fertile farmlands near the Mediterranean, on the Mediterranean coast, roughly between Tyre in the north and Acre in the south, in that section of the Mediterranean there, right north of Israel, in the northern part of Israel. It's very fertile, and so Asher's called happy or blessed. And he, Asher, will yield royal dainties. The NIV translates that this way, he will provide delicacies fit for a king, which is a little bit clearer. Rich food, that's what Asher's famous for, prosperity. That came to pass also. We go now to Genesis. So Jacob shows that he is a true prophet. We go now to Genesis 49, verse 21. Naphtali is a doe let loose. He gives beautiful words. Naphtali is the tribe that runs south to north on the east of the Sea of Galilee and Lake Hula, all the way up in its northern tip to the Lebanon Valley and Mount Hermon up there. And it extends westward halfway to the Mediterranean Sea. Naphtali's western border is Asher, which, as I just said, was on the Mediterranean coast between Acre and Tyre. So this is Naphtali. He's compared to a doe let loose. Now that's a sort of a obscure reference, so we're going to have different options to interpret that. Here's the NIV's study Bible's option. This is perhaps a reference to a spirit of independence, a doe let loose. A doe let loose is pretty independent. John Gill agrees with the NIV Study Bible. Gill says this, quote, he says this referring to the people of Naphtali, quote, kind and loving, swift and expeditious in their affairs, lovers of liberty, well-spoken persons, humane, affable, courteous, of a good address, and pleasing language. Well, the part of that quote I want to focus on is when Gill says they are lovers of liberty, as a doe is a lover of liberty. Actually, I think that the NIV Study Bible and Gill are right on this point. I think that's what the metaphor refers to. Here's some other options. Naphtali is located far away in the hill country north of Galilee, as I just said. Well, that's like a doe running long, long, far away. So the point of the metaphor, according to this view, is Naphtali is a long way from where a deer might have started out. Option number three, deer are fast. And likewise, Naphtali is quick to bring forth fruit. Well, that's a strained metaphor, in my opinion. That's John Gill's idea. Now, here's another view, is that Naphtali running like a deer loose refers to Barak, who was from Naphtali. He was of the tribe of Naphtali. Of course, Barak is the famous general that fought for Deborah in the battle against Sisera, the pagan king in the north of Israel there. And the way the metaphor works, according to this view, is that Barak was fearful like a deer when he was called by Deborah to battle, but afterwards he gave beautiful words in the song of Deborah and Barak. That's referring to Jacob saying, Naphtali is a doe let loose, he gives beautiful words. That's assuming the translation is beautiful words. We're going to see in a minute it might not be. And so that makes that option a little bit questionable, not to mention the fact it seems a little bit strained. I think that the best way we need to refer, we need to interpret this is that deers are independent by nature. I have them, they show up in my backyard all the time. And by golly, you make the slightest noise and off they run. They're not the most, they're not sociable with, they're not like dogs. They're not even like cats. They like to be free. They like to be loose. Now, the last part of the verse says, Naphtali gives beautiful words. We need to look at other ways that that phrase is translated. The NIV translates it this way. Naphtali is a doe set free that bears beautiful fawns. A doe that bears beautiful fawns. In other words, it's not Naphtali giving beautiful words. It's that doe that was let loose is giving beautiful baby deer, fawns. Now, that's not a one-off translation. The Holman Christian Study Bible translates it exactly the same way. So, could go either way. The NIV note does recognize the New American Standard Translation, which is, he speaks beautiful words. So, it's, I guess it's 50-50 on how we're going to translate that. I guess if you translate it beautiful falls, then it doesn't really mean anything. It's just a part of the doe metaphor. Doesn't mean a thing. Now, there's another way to translate it, according to Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown, and this might be one off because I didn't check to see whether this is reasonable or not. He shooteth forth goodly branches. And Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown says you interpret that as majestic antlers. So he's like a doe let loose who gives forth goodly branches or antlers. That's really a stretch if you ask me. And then how would you interpret that? Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown said that Naphtali would spread in the hill country like a deer's antlers stretching out. Well, that's the trouble with poetry. Everybody's got their own view of it. I think my preference is that Naphtali was independent like a loose deer. Of course, how that is fulfilled in history, I don't know. We go to Genesis 49, verse 22. Joseph is a fruitful bough by a spring. Its branches run over a wall. Now, if you think about that, say a vine grows up near a wall and the branches end up running over the wall. That's just the way they do. And of course, if it's watered by a spring, they're going to grow even faster. That vine's going to grow even faster. Now, Joseph is said to be a fruitful bough. He's son number 11. The name fruitful is a pun on the name Ephraim. Remember, Joseph got blessed because of his two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh. They were the ones that received Joseph's double portion, one portion for Ephraim and one for Manasseh. Fruitful is a pun on the name Ephraim, as the NIV Study Bible points out. Ephraim means twofold increased or doubly fruitful. Now, Jacob had already predicted in the previous chapter when he was talking to Joseph about this. He had predicted that Ephraim would be greater than Manasseh. We read that in Genesis 48, verses 19 and 20. But his father, that's Joseph's father, Jacob, refused and said, I know, my son, I know he also will become a people and he will also be great. This is when Joseph tried to uncross Jacob's hand as Jacob switches the blessing from Manasseh to Ephraim. Jacob continues in verse 19, Genesis 48, however, his younger brother shall be greater than he. His younger brother Ephraim shall be greater than Manasseh, and his descendants shall become a multitude of nations. He blessed them that day, saying, by you, Israel, that's Jacob, were pronounced blessings, saying, may God make you like Ephraim and Manasseh. Thus he put Ephraim before Manasseh. But here, the blessing to Joseph is all included in one blessing to Joseph. Ephraim and Manasseh are not mentioned, are not split out separately. Joseph is mentioned alone. So this fruitfulness was referring to not only Ephraim, but Manasseh as the increase of population is likened to branches of a vine running over a wall. Now, Ephraim's descendants, as well as Manasseh's, tended to expand their territory. We can see that in Joshua 17, verses 14 through 18. Then the sons of Joseph spoke to Joshua, saying, why have you given me only one lot and one portion for an inheritance? Remember, the sons of Joseph are Ephraim and Manasseh. Since I am a numerous people whom the Lord has thus far blessed. Each one of them is saying that individually, I, Ephraim, and I, Manasseh. Joshua said to them, if you are a numerous people, go up to the forest and clear a place for yourself there in the land of the Perizzites and of the Rephaim, since the hill country of Ephraim is too narrow for you. The sons of Joseph said, the hill country is not enough for us, and all the Canaanites who live in the valley land have chariots of iron, both those who are in Bethshan and its towns and those who are in the valley of Jezreel. Joshua spoke to the house of Joseph, to Ephraim and Manasseh, saying, you are a numerous people and have great power. You shall not have one lot only, but the hill country shall be yours also. And of course, Ephraim is right there north of Jerusalem, right where Samaria was in that area. Manasseh was, half of it was east of the Jordan up in the north. And the other half was west of the Jordan, right north of Ephraim, spreading from the Jordan River to the Mediterranean Sea. In fact, if you take the area between the Sea of Galilee and the Dead Sea, that the Jordan River there, and go all the way to the Mediterranean. That's pretty close to where Manasseh is. All right, well, going back to Joshua 17, verse 17, let me just read that again. Joseph spoke to the house of Joseph, to Ephraim and Manasseh, saying, "You are a numerous people and have great power. You shall not have one lot only, but the hill country shall be yours." Now remember, this is the purpose of this quotation, is to show you how they are fruitful like a vine that crawls over the wall. It's because they have so many people. "You are a numerous people and have great power, but the hill country shall be yours, for though it is a forest, you shall clear it, and to its farthest borders it shall be yours. For you shall drive out the Canaanites, even though they have chariots of iron." So basically, the sons of Joseph are very, very numerous. We see the same thing in Deuteronomy 33:17. "As the firstborn of his ox, majesty is his, and his horns are the horns of the wild ox. With them he will push the peoples." Again, we're talking about Ephraim and Manasseh here. "All at once to the ends of the earth, and those are the 10,000s of Ephraim, and those are the thousands of Manasseh." Of course, Ephraim has more population than Manasseh because Ephraim was favored. We know that. But the point is, the children of Joseph are going to be like rabbits, multiplying profusely. We go now to Genesis 49, verses 23 through 25. Still referring to Joseph. "The archers bitterly attacked him and shot at him and harassed him, but his bow remained firm and his arms were agile from the hands of the mighty one of Jacob. From there is the shepherd, the stone of Israel, from the God of your father who helps you, and by the Almighty who blesses you with blessings of heaven above, blessings of the deep that lies beneath, blessings of the breasts and of the womb." Now in verse 23, the archers are said to bitterly attack Joseph. What does that mean? Here's three options. Option number one is referring to the time when Joseph's brothers sold Joseph into slavery. Gill and Clark cite that. Cambridge commentary denies it. Ellicott agrees with that idea. Quote, "Naturally, Jacob next describes the sorrows of Joseph's youth, but in poetical terms, so as not to wound the feelings of his brethren or rouse up thoughts of vengeance in Joseph's own mind." And he's pretty strong on that. Ellicott is. He acts like there's no other view here, but there's other commentators who deny it, for I mentioned already Cambridge commentary, but also Kyle and Delitzsch, the famous commentators, they deny that too. So here's option number two, not referring to arrows of Joseph's youth when he was sold into slavery, but actually option number two refers to the wars of the Ephraimites with the Canaanites, as the Ephraimites had to run out the Canaanites as they crossed the Jordan River under Joshua. Kyle and Delitzsch says that these arrows that attack Joseph and go against him refer to, quote, "the conflicts awaiting his descendants in which they would constantly overcome all hostile attacks." Now you notice here the split of interpretation has to do is Joseph referring to the person of Joseph or the descendants of Joseph? We'll see this a lot as we go through here. I tend to think it's usually referring to the descendants, not the actual son himself. And one reason I say that in this case is because in verse 24 it says his bow remained firm. What did that have to do with him being attacked by his brothers? His bow didn't remain firm against his brothers, and his arms were agile. No, that talks about a warrior, and that sounds like the tribe of Ephraim. So that's option number two, wars of the Ephraimites with the Canaanites. That's what it means by arrows attacking Joseph. Here's another option. It's referring to Joseph's sufferings in Egypt. Remember, he was enslaved, put in jail. Kyle and Delitzsch deny that option, the archers bitterly attacking Joseph. I mean, I don't know for sure, but I really think that it's referring to the Ephraimites getting attacked by the Canaanites. In verse 24, "His Ephraim's bow remained firm. The warlike Ephraimites would often prove successful in battle." Here's some scripture showing their success, Judges 8:1. "Then the men of Ephraim said to Gideon, 'What is this thing you have done to us, not calling us when you went to fight against Midian?' And they contended with him vigorously." You would think they would be happy they didn't have to go fight the Midianites with Gideon, but they were warlike enough to say, "No, we want to go." Probably looking for some spoil. Judges 12:1. "Then the men of Ephraim were summoned, and they crossed to Zaphon and said to Jephthah," Jephthah's one of the judges, "'When did you, Jephthah, cross over to fight against the sons of Ammon? Or why did you do that without calling us to go with you? We will burn your house down on you.'" So the Ephraimites are ready to go to battle. Joshua 17:18. "But the hill country shall be yours, for though it is a forest, you shall clear it. Into its farthest borders it shall be yours, for you shall drive out the Canaanites, even though they have chariots of iron and though they are strong." So Joshua says, "Ephraim, you're going to wipe out the Canaanites in your territory that's been allotted to you." So they were a successful warrior tribe. And Jacob refers to that when he says, Ephraim's bow shall remain firm. Now, Jacob refers to God here from the hands of the Mighty One of Jacob, Jacob himself. The Mighty One of Jacob, of course, is Yahweh. From there is the shepherds. His God is called a shepherd. As a name for God, it's used only here and in one other place in Genesis 48:15, when Jacob blessed Joseph and said, the God before whom my fathers Abraham and Isaac walked, the God who has been my shepherd all my life to this day. Now, of course, Jesus is a shepherd too, and it's used a lot in the New Testament. It's interesting, twice it's used as God is a shepherd. God is also called the Stone of Israel by Jacob here in verse 24. A stone is heavy, solid, and will not be moved. Kind of just like God. You're not going to move God. Jacob, in referring to God as a shepherd, as a stone, he next says that the Almighty blesses you, Joseph, Ephraim and Manasseh, the sons of Joseph, who blesses you with blessings of heaven above. Here's an example of that blessing. Hosea 12:8. And Ephraim said, remember, Ephraim's a child of Joseph, the son of Joseph, who was most successful, even though he was the youngest. And Ephraim said, surely I have become rich. I have found wealth for myself, and all my labors that will find me no iniquity, which would be sin. So Ephraim's very happy of the blessings of God. There the blessings were financial. And these blessings came from heaven above and in the deep that lies beneath the heaven above. That's rain, which makes his crops grow. And from the earth beneath, the deep that lies beneath, that's talking about subterranean springs, which spring up and cause crops to grow. Verse 25, there's another aspect of this blessing for Joseph. Blessings of the breast and of the womb. Blessings of the breast is kind of a strange expression. It means an increase of children, as the NIV Study Bible, John Gill and Adam Clark say, because children, when they get born, they nurse at their mother's breast. And so blessings of the breast means blessings of kids who are nursing at their mother's breast. In other words, it's children. Those were considered a big blessing back there in those days, unlike today, where so many people think they're a burden. They're children. And the blessings of Joseph through Ephraim and Manasseh are recorded in the book of Numbers. The first census in the book of Numbers has Ephraim and Manasseh together having 75,900 men. They beat them all. The next biggest tribe was Judah. Judah had 74,600 men, which was close, but not quite as big as Ephraim and Manasseh put together. Now, the population of Joseph's children, Ephraim and Manasseh, had increased so much that in the days of Joshua, a common lot was not enough. We read this in Joshua 17, verse 14. Then the sons of Joseph spoke to Joshua, saying, why have you given me only one lot and one portion for an inheritance? Since I am a numerous people whom the Lord has thus far blessed, not enough room for all those people. Now, notice in verse 25, that Joseph is to be blessed, Ephraim and Manasseh are to be blessed with blessings of the womb as well as of the breast. Well, what are blessings of the womb? Well, I just assume that was a repetition of blessings of the breast. Little babies nursing at their mother's breast. Well, actually, according to NIV Study Bible, John Gill and Adam Clark, the womb there is talking about an increase of cattle, a cow's womb, which surprised me, actually, but I guess they know what they're talking about. We go now to Genesis 49, verse 26. Jacob continues talking to Joseph. The blessings of your father have surpassed the blessings of my ancestors up to the utmost bound of the everlasting hills. May they be on the head of Joseph and on the crown of the head of the one distinguished among his brothers. May they, means the blessings, be on the head of Joseph. Now, Jacob says to Joseph, the blessings of your father, that was referring to Joseph's father, Jacob, so he's referring to himself, my blessings, have surpassed the blessings of my ancestors. That would be Abraham and Isaac. Well, what he's saying is that Jacob and his offspring had more offspring than Abraham and Isaac had. Abraham had two, Isaac and Ishmael. Isaac had Jacob and Esau, two. Jacob had 68. He came up from Canaan to Egypt, his famous 70 minus Ur and Onan, who had died. Then he lived for 17 more years in Egypt, and I presume his offspring were having more offspring during those 17 years. So, yes, he had more offspring than Abraham and Isaac. And also, he had an advantage because half of Abraham's progeny, Ishmael, was cut out of the promised seed, and half of Isaac's offspring, Esau was cut out of the promised seed. Well, that wasn't true of Jacob. All of his offspring were included in the promised blessings. And so he says, oh, may all the blessings, and when the Jews talked about blessings, they're talking about children, seed, offspring, mostly, probably, as well as wealth, but mostly offspring. May they be on the head of Joseph. Blessings overcoming Joseph right on top of his head, on the crown of his head. He compares blessings that he wants to see come on Joseph compared to the utmost bound of the everlasting hills. Well, the hills are tall, the utmost bound, that's NASB for tall, the tallest height of the hills. So the blessings are tall and they're everlasting. They're like those hills, they last forever. To use two clumsy metaphors there, but it gives you the feel there of what Jacob is asking for Joseph. And then he says, Joseph is distinguished among his brothers in verse 26. The NIV says that Joseph is a prince among his brothers. What does that mean? Well, two options. Option number one, Ephraim would gain supremacy, especially over the northern tribes. That would be the NIV Study Bible solution, Hosea 13:1. When Ephraim spoke, there was trembling. He, Ephraim, exalted himself in Israel. Okay. But the other option is, it's talking about not Joseph's descendants, the tribe of Ephraim, but rather Joseph himself, because he was more distinguished at that time than all of his brothers. He was viceroy of Egypt. And again, there's your problem. Do you refer the blessing to the son himself personally, or do you refer Jacob's blessing to the offspring of his sons? And I tend to want to go with the offspring, because I think that's what Jacob's aiming at, is that promise, the promise of the father. We go now to Genesis 49, 27 through 28. We're down to the last child, Benjamin, number 12. Benjamin is a ravenous wolf. In the morning he devours the prey, and in the evening he divides the spoil. All these are the 12 tribes of Israel, and this is what their father said to them when he blessed them. He blessed them every one with the blessing appropriate to him. Benjamin is a ravenous wolf. Now here's some examples, four examples of Benjamites who behaved like a wolf. A ravenous wolf. Let's start with Ehud. He was a Benjamite. He was a left-handed judge in Judges chapter 3. He stabbed the fat king of Moab, whose name was Eglon. He stabbed him in the gut. That left hand thrust there threw Eglon off his guard. Well, that was pretty wolf-like. How about Saul? He was from Benjamin. How did he treat Jonathan? How did he treat David? Chased him all through the wilderness. Of course, Jonathan was allied with David. But especially, how did he treat David? Like a wolf. Tried to kill him. This is even a better example. How about the Benjamite in Judges 19 through 21 who showed some hospitality to strangers, and as a reward, the strangers raped the man's daughter. And as a result, the Benjamites chopped the daughter up into 12 pieces and sent each piece of his daughter to each of the tribes. That's something that I don't think you're going to see too much these days. That's pretty rough. That's pretty ravenous, like a wolf. How about Paul? He was of the tribe of Benjamin, if you recall. Before he was saved, he went around trying to judicially murder Christians, get them arrested, send them off to jail. He said he persecuted them to the death, he said, in Acts. Here's what Jameson Fawcett Brown says about the tribe of Benjamin. This tribe in its early history spent its energies in petty or inglorious warfare, and especially in the violent and unjust contest in which it engaged with the other tribes. When notwithstanding two victories, it was almost exterminated. That's referring to the story I just told you about the Benjamite's daughter who got raped, and then the Benjamite got upset about all that. It's a long story, but he ended up fighting all the other tribes, almost got wiped out. All right, so Benjamin is a ravenous wolf. In the morning, he devours the prey. In the evening, he divides the spoil, kind of just like a wolf does. Now, we finish with the 12 sons. We go to verse 28. All these are the 12 tribes of Israel. Now, there were actually 13 because of Joseph's two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh. Take Joseph out, get you 11, add Ephraim and Manasseh, that's 13. But Levi inherited nothing, so we subtract one for Levi, and there's 12. Let me say this. We always hear of the 12 tribes of Israel, but depending on which list you look at, it depends on which tribes are listed. There's one. I remember there's one list in Revelation that doesn't match the one here, and you know, you go on and on. So you have to watch for that. We now go to Genesis 49, verse 29 through 33, and we'll finish the chapter. Then he, that's Jacob, charged the sons, and said to them, I am about to be gathered to my people. In other words, I'm about to die. Bury me with my fathers in the cave that is in the field of Ephron the Hittite, in the cave that is in the field of Machpelah, which is before Mamre in the land of Canaan. Well, before we go any further, let's just identify what that is. That's in Hebron. In Hebron, there was a field there that belonged to Ephron the Hittite. And if you recall, Jacob bought that field from Ephron the Hittite. And there was an oak tree near that field. It's called the Oak of Mamre. and the field itself was called Machpelah. It was in the land of Canaan in general, Hebron in particular. Hebron, of course, is about a third of the way down from the northern tip of the Dead Sea, a little bit to the west there on the road from down from Jerusalem, Bethlehem to Hebron, on the way to Beersheba. So Jacob was very careful to delineate, this is where I want you to bury me, this field, which Abraham bought along with the field from Ephron the Hittite for a burial site. There they buried Abraham and his wife Sarah. There they buried Isaac and his wife Rebekah. And there I buried Leah. Rachel, of course, didn't make it down there. She died on the way. She was in Bethlehem. The field and the cave that is in it, the field of Machpelah, the cave that's in the field, purchased from the sons of Heth, that's the Hittites, famous tribe. When Jacob finished charging his sons, he drew his feet into the bed and breathed his last and was gathered to his people. Now, the cave at Machpelah, Adam Clark said that's the first public burying place in history. I don't know why he says that, because if it belonged to Jacob, I fail to see how it was public. But at any rate, Jacob's sons carried out Jacob's wish, and they carried him to that cave of Machpelah in Hebron. Genesis 50, verse 13, next chapter. For his sons carried him to the land of Canaan and buried him in the cave of the field of Machpelah before Mamre, which Abraham had bought along with the field for a burial site from Ephron the Hittite. Now that promise that Jacob exacted from his sons is the same promise he exacted from Joseph two chapters earlier, Genesis 47, 29 through 31. This is privately, without all the other brothers being there. When the time for Israel to die drew near, that's Jacob, Jacob, called his son Joseph and said to him, please, if I have found favor in your sight, place now your hand under my thigh and deal with me in kindness and faithfulness. Please do not bury me in Egypt. But when I lie down with my fathers, you shall carry me out of Egypt and bury me in their burial place. That, of course, is Hebron. And he said, Joseph said, I will do as you have said. Jacob said, swear to me. So he swore to him. Then Israel bowed and worshiped at the head of the bed. All right. So we need to ask is why Jacob spent so much time getting Joseph individually and the brothers collectively to promise to bury him in Israel, because that's the promised land. Egypt is not the promised land. He's carrying out the wishes of God, his father, because of those promises that were made to Abraham, a promise of land, offspring, and blessings. The land blessing was very important. Of course, that land blessing is a type ultimately fulfilled in the kingdom of God in the new covenant. And so, of course, Jacob didn't know all that, but he knew about that land promise, and he wanted to be buried there. Now, Jacob's careful to say that Abraham bought that field. He says that in verse 30. Why does he say that? He wants to make sure that there's no misunderstanding. Hey, if any of Ephron's descendants lay claim to that field, remember, Abraham bought it. So defend the title. Now, we would not know Rebekah was buried at Hebron, except that it's mentioned here by Jacob. Also, it says, there I buried Leah. When that happened, we don't know, but we know that Leah was there. So his mother Rebekah was there, his wife Leah was there, his second wife, and of course his father Isaac was there. Isaac's wife Rebekah was there, and also Abraham and Sarah were there. So this is definitely the cave of Machpelah, the cave of the patriarchs. It's still a tourist place there, I think. Of course, who knows how much it's been changed since then. And I think it's the Palestinians control it in the West Bank, but it's called the cave of the patriarchs. Famous place, so we need to remember Hebron. Some one of my commentators, and I don't know which one, I forgot to write it down, speculates that Rebekah actually died before Isaac, and that Isaac had buried Rebekah here in that cave. That's speculation. Nobody knows, but somehow she got buried there. Now we go to verse 33. When Jacob finished charging his sons, he drew his feet into the bed and breathed his last. Now why would Jacob draw his feet into his bed? John Gill says, to put himself in a proper posture for death. Now, that immediately makes me wonder, well, how did he know he was going to die that soon? It's surprising to me that he could predict so closely when he would die. Jameson Fawcett Brown addresses that issue and says this, quote, it is probable that he was supernaturally strengthened for this last momentous office of the patriarch, and that when the divine afflatus ceased, the afflatus means spirit, his exhausted powers giving way, he yielded up the ghost and was gathered unto his people. Gathered, of course, means dying. That's where the Hebrews said they died. And of course, he died at the age of 147. And we are now finished with chapter 49. The sons have been blessed, their futures predicted in prophecy. And now we are ready to go to chapter 50 in our next audio, verses 1 through 26, the entire chapter. And we will read about how Jacob died. Of course, he just died in this last verse, but we'll continue with the story of his death and also Joseph's death in chapter 50. I hope you stay tuned for that audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.